Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. Coming up in this episode, I'm in conversation with Winfried Henzinger, who is co-founder of the UK-based company Universal Quantum, which has just received seed funding that sets it on course to its goal of creating a million-qubit quantum computer. Also on hand is Physics World student contributor Robin Carr, who will explain how photosynthesizing microbes can boost the performance of solar cells. But first, let's talk about neutrons and COVID-19. Scientists around the world are using myriad techniques to gain a better understanding of the SARS coronavirus that is responsible for the COVID-19 epidemic. Neutron scattering offers unique opportunities to work out the structure of the virus and the biological molecules that are involved in how it infects humans and replicates itself. To talk about how neutrons are being used in the fight against this deadly virus, I'm joined down the line by Giovanna Fragneto, who is leader of the Large-Scale Structures Group at the Institut Laue-Langevin in Grenoble, France. Hi, Giovanna. Welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast.
Hi, Hamish.
So just to get us started, how can neutrons be used to gain insights into viruses such as the SARS coronavirus?
Well, neutrons are particularly suitable for research in biology in general, so will be useful for virus research as well. The interest of using neutrons is due to the fact that they allow you to highlight, they're very sensitive, first of all, to very light elements that compose biological materials, and in particular to hydrogens. They are non-destructive. They allow you to work in physiological conditions, and you can highlight parts of your systems that are not distinguishable with other techniques because they are chemically very similar. So in the case of viruses, there are different things that neutrons can do. One of them is to look at how drugs bind to molecules that facilitate the replication of the virus and stop them. In particular, we can see with crystallography techniques how hydrogen bonds between the drugs and the molecule. And this is a feature that is unique to neutrons. Any other sophisticated method like X-ray crystallography or cryo-EM would not allow you to do so. On another side, another important point, so we can look at how the virus interacts with the membranes of cells. And here we can highlight the proteins in the viruses or the membranes in a way to have a look at the nanometer scale, at the fraction of nanometer scale of the interaction with membranes, and then the mechanism of introduction of the viruses into cells. And we do this with scattering techniques like small angle scattering techniques or reflectometry techniques optimized to see membranes.
And so the key here is that you tend to be looking at hydrogen, which is, am I right to say that hydrogen is pretty well invisible to a technique like X-ray diffraction, whereas neutrons are very sensitive to hydrogen? Is that the key?
This is one of the most important points. It's not only that we are sensitive to hydrogens, but also we can play with what we call isotopic substitution. So we can replace the hydrogens in a compound with the deuterium, and this will scatter in a very different way and will allow us to highlight parts of the systems compared to other parts. I mean, what I mean, if you have a hydrogenous protein and a deuterated membrane, the chemical composition of the protein and the membrane is very similar. But when you deuterate, the scattering signal is going to be very different, and you can see how the protein would insert into the membrane or stay on the top of the membrane. And this would be very difficult with any other technique. We have this power of highlighting the interesting parts of our system.
I think a lot of our listeners will know something about neutron diffraction, but you mentioned another technique, neutron reflectometry. How does that technique work?
Now, neutron reflectometry allows you to study material on surfaces and obtain information down to the angstrom scale. What we would normally do in this kind of studies, in biological studies, we would model a cell membrane on a planar surface, planar macroscopic surface. So we have this membrane that is 5 nanometers thick on a very big surface. Put it in contact with a protein, a peptide, a drug, or else. Send our neutrons at a very, very small angle of incidence and collect the signal that is reflected after interaction with the material on the surface at the interface. And by studying the way it is reflected, we gain information at the angstrom scale on the structure on the surface and the composition on the surface.
And what is the current status of ILL? I mean, I should explain for perhaps listeners who aren't familiar with this facility. It's a nuclear reactor that produces neutrons that are used to mostly do structural studies of materials and molecules. Is the ILL running at the moment? And can you do experiments on the SARS coronavirus, or are you sort of at the stage of planning experiments that you can do when the facility switches on?
So we were meant to be running at the moment, but because of the COVID crisis, we had to postpone the start of our reactor. So we will restart the 11th of August before starting a reactor cycle. There is some work to be done, so we needed to wait that the situation kind of stabilized in Europe, and also we welcome users from other countries, so we wanted to make sure that we could have people from other countries. So we will restart the 11th of August until end of September. The reactor will be running, and it's then that we will be doing experiments that we are preparing now. So what we are doing now, we are preparing all the components in terms of both of proteases, deuterated material, deuterated lipids especially. We are getting peptides to look at the fusion of peptides with membranes, relevant peptides into the coronavirus structure. And now we are doing all the preparatory work, and we will do experiments in the second half of August.
Neutrons have been used previously to investigate the HIV virus.
Yes.
Can you talk a bit about that? You know, what sort of information about the virus was gleaned using neutrons?
Well, again, the neutrons were very important to look at the structure of drug molecules with inhibitors of the viruses. What was really the interaction of the drug with the protein, the position of protons, and was the important part.
Are you hopeful that sort of similar studies involving drugs against COVID-19 could be done at ILL in the future.
But definitely. I mean, that would be an ideal facility to do that, because we can get very good crystal structures of drugs interacting with crystals with our instruments.
And that sort of research, who would be involved in that? Would that be a real sort of international effort involving academics at universities, drug companies, people at ILL?
Usually it is. So this is the way we usually work. With the scientists at the ILL provides the expertise for running the experiment, analyzing the data. But then there are always collaborations with academia to provide the system. And in cases like this, there would be collaborations with drug companies who provide the drug. That's the normal way of working.
So in Grenoble, where ILL is, you also have the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility, as well as the European Molecular Biology Lab. I'm guessing that ILL will be working in concert with those facilities to do some of this work. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. We have partnerships in place on the campus, so between all facilities. And actually, you forgot to mention, on campus, we have also the IBS, the Institut de Biologie Structurale, that is a structural biology institute where there are groups specialized in virus research. Well-known groups specialized, and we interact strongly with them to obtain the protein that we will be using in neutron experiments. In particular, the spike protein, which is using the typical image of the coronavirus. So you have these red parts that come out, mm-hmm. that are called the spike protein. And we are going to look at the interaction of this protein with membranes, with receptors into membranes.
And given your experience with HIV, are you hopeful that that there's going to be lots of very useful information produced using neutrons with regards to the SARS coronavirus?
I think if there is a good effort with the user community to provide proteins and eventually drugs and systems to study, we should be able to be in the same position as for HIV to give useful information. People here, the facilities are very interested in pursuing research in this sense, but of course we need the support of virology laboratories. And I think it is very likely that we will create strong collaborations. Within LENS, we have started a series of webinars to try to attract labs involved in health problems and others. And we had a webinar last week on viruses and how neutrons can help. It was rather successful. So I believe there is an interest and there is an understanding of the potentiality of these neutron techniques.
And LENS is an organization of neutron scattering facilities, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, League for Neutron Scattering, European League for Neutron Scattering.
And I'll put a link to that webinar in the notes to the podcast. So our listeners can take a look at that. Well, good luck, Giovanna, with your work on SARS coronavirus. I'm sure you know that just about everybody on this planet is wishing you success. And thanks so much for appearing on the Physics World Weekly podcast.
Thank you.
When I was an undergraduate studying quantum mechanics in the 1980s, concepts like entanglement and superposition were abstract, to say the least. Although we did touch on the weirdness of quantum physics, the emphasis was very much on calculating observable entities like the energy spectrum of a harmonic oscillator. Today, however, these abstract concepts have been put to work in quantum information systems. And you can buy a commercial quantum encryption system or access a nascent quantum computer via the internet. One player in this booming quantum industry is Universal Quantum, which spun out of the UK's University of Sussex in 2018 and has now received £3.6 million in a seed funding round. To talk about Universal Quantum, I'm joined down the line from Brighton by Sussex's Winfried Henzinger, who co-founded the company with his colleague Sebastian Veit. Hi, Winfried. Congratulations on getting that seed funding.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Winfried, maybe we could start with a few basics here. What are the advantages of quantum computing over conventional computing?
So quantum computers are really entirely a new type of technology to do computations. And in a very short sentence, quantum computers can solve certain problems where even the fastest supercomputer may take billions of years to calculate. And so examples of such problems are simulating other physical systems. And so that may have an implication on maybe making new materials, understanding chemical reactions, creating new pharmaceuticals, optimization problems, which are relevant in the financial sector. And we're only just at the beginning right now to fully understand the full range of problems that can be solved with a quantum computer.
And there are several different ways at the moment of making a quantum computer. And Universal Quantum has chosen to use trapped ions as qubits, quantum bits. Can you give us an idea of how this works?
Yeah, let me maybe give you a bit of an introduction first of why we're using trapped ions and then tell you how that works. So there's different hardware platforms being used to build quantum computers, and a famous one, for example, consists of superconducting qubits. The challenge with such a platform is that you have to cool the qubits all the way to -273 degrees Celsius, actually to millikelvin temperatures, and when you do that, the cooling power is very limited at that low temperature, and that in turn means that it's very hard to imagine building quantum computers with maybe millions of qubits, because obviously that would require a substantial amount of cooling power. And so so it's very important to think of application development, and many applications do require millions of qubits. And that's why we are using trapped ions, because trapped ions are temperature which works at room temperature. And in fact, we're using it at a temperature of 70 Kelvin, so a liquid nitrogen temperature. And at that temperature, you still have plenty, many, many orders of magnitude more cooling power available. So trapped ions is a technology where you use electric fields to hold an ion inside a vacuum. And this all started with the development of clocks, where an ion was used as a time standard. And the way an ion was trapped was with a macroscopic set of electrodes that is emitting spinning electric fields, and these electric fields then produce what's called a ponderomotive potential, which is capable of holding an ion in free space. So that's how this whole field started. And now, thinking about quantum computing, you obviously have to have in mind that you're going to have to build systems with which then eventually hold millions of ions, each ion being one qubit. And so around 20 years ago, people started thinking about building microchips that could now host a set of electrodes. And that was actually the time when I got really interested in quantum computing. And so I then went to the University of Michigan, and I had a contact actually then at the Laboratory for Physical Science, where I worked before to build microchips to trap neutral atoms. And so we talked about this, and we came up with a new idea of how you could now build a microchip ion trap. And that indeed, after some years of development, worked. And that was actually one of the very first ion microchips in the world that could now hold ions on a microchip rather than a set of metallic electrodes.
And I think one of the features of your particular architecture is that you use microwaves to manipulate the ions. Do you have to use lasers as well? Because my understanding is that the fewer lasers you need, the more practical it is to operate the system. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. So when ion trapping quantum computing started, people very, very successfully used laser beams to execute quantum gates. And the way that works is you have to focus two laser beams with an accuracy around 5 or 10 microns on the position of a trapped ion. And that's easily doable in a laboratory experiment if you have a handful of ions. If you have 5 or 10 ions, and obviously it's very easy using mirrors to align these laser beams onto the right position. Now, imagine you want to build a useful quantum computer. And when I say useful, I mean maybe that machine would have to host millions of qubits. And if you wanted to do that, and you have to imagine trying to build a machine where you'd have to align millions of pairs of laser beams. And if any of these laser beams moves, or the amplitude of the power of the laser beam fluctuates, or even a piece of dust falls in one of the mirrors, then this machine won't work anymore. And so that's the reason why myself and others have been thinking about possibilities of how you can build a quantum computer with trapped ions using microwaves instead of lasers, because microwaves is what we use in mobile phones. It's electronics essentially. You don't have to align these; you irradiate them just within your quantum computer. And we found then actually in 2016 we found a fantastic way to use microwaves, which was really based on an invention of a pioneer in microwave quantum computing, Christoph Wunderlich, in 2001. We then modified this idea and came up with an approach where you could simply execute quantum gates by applying voltage on a microchip, making use of microwaves. And that now allows for a very, very simple implementation of quantum gates. And the big advantage is now you really kind of get back to the architecture of a conventional computer where you use transistors, which work in the same way, where you just apply voltages in order to implement a logical gate. Now, we are still using some laser beams, but the laser beams we still use are what we call global laser beams. So you take a laser beam through what's called a cylindrical lens, and that then produces a light sheet. And that light sheet can really interact with numerous ions, hundreds or even thousands of ions simultaneously. And we've created an architecture where we indeed show how all of this would come together, and where making use of a few laser beams, but executing the quantum gates using electronics, you can then build a successful architecture that could then give rise to a machine that could hold millions of qubits, and that could actually really execute useful calculations.
And you talk about millions of qubits. I mean, I'm guessing that you haven't quite got to that point yet. But isn't it the case that you can actually, because a quantum computer has such a potential, that you don't really need millions of qubits to do a useful calculation. Is that right?
So in quantum computing, there's two type of regimes for computation. And one is often referred to as NISQ. And NISQ means you use qubits where you are happy that they have a kind of small error. And there are certain applications you can do in this type of regime which may be useful. And there's a large number of theorists around the world working really hard right now to come up with applications for this type of computational regime. Now, the really big and interesting applications of quantum computing, so these big algorithms, like I'll give you an example, like breaking RSA encryption, for example, they really require extended algorithms. And if you have an extended quantum algorithm, then even if the errors are very small, then eventually they will add up and render this quantum computer useless. And in fact, that's why many critics of quantum computing in the early days said, look, this is all a grand idea, but it will never work because you're always going to have some errors and they eventually end up to then render this computationally useless. So like it often happens in a case like this, some really amazing theorists looked at that and came up with a way to get around that. And they invented the idea of quantum error correction. And in fact, one step further, the idea of fault tolerant quantum computing. What that means is that you can show that if all the operations in your quantum computer have an error below a certain level, like, for example, maybe below 1%, then making use of a lot of extra qubits, you can show that you can run any arbitrary quantum algorithm of any arbitrary length, and it will still be successful. However, there's a price to pay. So nothing is for free, and here there's also a price to pay. And the price to pay here is that you have to have a lot of extra quantum bits. So imagine your quantum algorithm may require 2,000 qubits. Then if you wanted to implement error correction, and imagine, for example, you have an error of 0.1%, then if your quantum algorithm may need 2,000 qubits, the quantum computer to execute this quantum algorithm using error correction may need a million or billions of qubits. And so this is where the reason comes from, that there's a lot of drive of people trying to think how you could build such a quantum computer. But you're absolutely right. It doesn't mean that there may not be, there are not useful applications for small qubit numbers. But the big gains in quantum computing, they will happen once we have machines that host billions of qubits.
And so how will Universal Quantum be spending this £3.6 million that you've got? Are you going to be developing ways of scaling up your technology so you can integrate more and more qubits?
So maybe this your previous question explains very well what is the reason and the motivation for Universal Quantum. So within the research group at the University of Sussex, for many years, we've developed proof of principle quantum computer prototypes that would demonstrate some of the key ideas in our quantum computing approach. But what is not possible in a university research group is do the necessary engineering, which is unbelievably expensive, to scale this to large numbers. And so what does that mean? You have to do a lot of CMOS development. You have to do really, really intricate engineering in order to scale this up to large numbers. So what we've received right now is only seed funding. So the amount of money is actually very small. And so it's only $3.6 million. But maybe the headline here is that we've received this from some very, very special investors. So one of the VCs is backed by Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg. There, another VC has a record of back Deliveroo before, and so these VCs are really helping us beyond just providing money, and in pushing this idea forward. Now, the $3.6 million is really only there to get us started in the first year, to get a key team running to get a site where we start work. But then within the next 12 months, we're already going to raise a lot more money because it's extremely expensive to build practical quantum computers. And part of what we want to do in the first year is to determine exactly the amount of funding required to do some of these really exciting developments we need to do. And so what are these developments? It's really to create a fully electronic quantum computing modules that have all these integrated features that allow us to basically create a quantum computing module hosting thousands of qubits that can be scaled up using a very special approach we developed at the University of Sussex. And if you're interested, I can tell you a little bit about that, because that's a really exciting way how to make quantum computing modular.
Oh yeah, please do.
So in trapped ion quantum computing, there's been a lot of push to get to a modular architecture. In fact, actually, any quantum computing architecture requires modularity. Why does a quantum computing architecture need to be modular? It's simple, because a commercial wafer or any kind of wafer will have a certain maximum size it can be, just in terms of the machines that make such a device. And so you can only fit a certain number of qubits onto such a wafer. Because one of the things which is actually common with trapped ions, the superconducting qubits, is that each qubit takes quite a bit of space. And so you can only maybe fit a few thousand qubits onto one of these wafers. So you have to have some kind of modular architecture. And the great thing about trapped ions is there's actually not just one architecture, but multiple architectures out there to make such a machine modular. One of these architectures is often referred to as photonic interconnects. The way that works is you take an optical fiber from one quantum computing module and you take it via a beam splitter onto a photodetector. And then you take another optical fiber from the other module you want to connect it to via the same beam splitter to another detector. Now, it turns out, and that's kind of hard to understand intuitively, but it turns out if an ion on one module emits a photon and an ion on the other module emits a photon, and they travel via these optical fibers via this beam splitter onto these detectors, and these detectors measure a coincident detection, it turns out we've entangled an ion on one module with an ion on the other module. So you have done a quantum gate between modules, you have connected these modules. And people for around 15 years have been working really hard of developing this method. It was originally pioneered by Chris Monroe at the University of Michigan. He's now at Maryland. It's also being developed at Oxford University. The challenge, however, is that this method is really, really complicated engineering-wise. You have to build this extremely complicated experimental setup, and with all the development available, the world record right now is at, I think, around 180 per second at 94% fidelity, in that when you distill this to a reasonable enough fidelity, you get to a few tens per second rate. So you can only connect quantum computer modules using this technique at a very slow rate, but the engineering is tremendously difficult. And so this is what motivated us at Sussex to try and to think, is there another way to achieve true modularity? And what we have come up with is an alternative solution where instead of using photonic interconnects, we use electric field links, where we take two quantum computing modules and we shape the electrodes on the edge of each quantum computing module in such a way that the electric field lines connect, and we can simply, by applying voltages, transport an ion from one quantum computing module to another quantum computing module. And that in turn allows to reach orders of magnitude faster connection speeds between quantum computing modules, but maybe more importantly, provide for a much, much simpler engineering solution. And so this is a technology which we now develop as part of Universal Quantum, besides what I already told you about, is the idea of implementing, executing quantum gates electronically rather than using laser beams.
Well, that's great, Winfried. Thanks for coming on the Physics World podcast. And you can find out much more about Universal Quantum on the company's website, which is universalquantum.com. So thanks again, Winfried.
Thank you for having me on the program. It was really nice talking to you.
Everyone knows that photosynthesis is nature's highly efficient way of converting sunlight into storable chemical energy. But it might come as a surprise that scientists and engineers have developed ways of incorporating photosynthesizing organisms into solar cells. To talk about this living technology, I'm joined down the line by Robin Carr, who is a PhD student contributor to Physics World. Robin is studying advanced materials at University College London and Imperial College London. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, in your latest article for Physics World, an article that's called Cyanobacteria and Nanomaterials Give Solar Cell a Boost, you describe some really fascinating work that's been done by researchers at Seoul National University and Dankook University in South Korea. Why did you choose to write about this paper? Why did it catch your eye?
Well, when choosing a paper to write about for Physics World, I usually look for something relevant to my own work. So that would be in the field of energy materials, especially solar power, but not necessarily directly related to that field. And I do this primarily to gain new ideas and also to avoid becoming repetitive because I wouldn't want to cover similar papers all the time. And I think this is a sentiment shared by a lot of the other student contributors. And I'm drawn to the notion of bioinspiration or biomimetics, where complex systems and structures often found in nature are used almost as a blueprint for human technology. So, I mean, I've come across a couple of examples previously, such as hydrophobic materials, which draw on the lotus effects for inspiration, thanks to its self-cleaning ability, the self-cleaning ability of lotus leaves, that is. And also some gloves that were developed quite famously at Stanford in America, which allow humans to climb walls inspired by geckos.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting, Robin, because, you know, both lotuses and geckos are two things that we've covered a lot on Physics World, you know, sort of mimicking their sort of amazing self-cleaning and climbing properties.
Yeah, and I think they're really useful and interesting examples. And I saw this paper in ACS Nano Letters, which was entitled A Broadband Multiplex Living Solar Cell, where the researchers actually went a step further beyond just using, in this case, cyanobacteria as inspiration. They actually implemented the cyanobacteria directly into the solar cell, to make use of their photosynthetic ability. And another reason I hope this paper might be interesting to Physics World readers is because, I mean, as you mentioned, there's a lot of attention given to solar power and also photosynthesis, with photosynthesis being a widely studied, very important process. And of course, I think it's only right that solar power gets as much attention as possible. But I've often wondered whether we as humans could utilize photosynthesis in our own energy production. And the answer is yes. It was actually shown a number of years ago to be possible. And it turns out that this paper is about producing a biophotovoltaic cell. That's a solar cell making use of biological systems with, but in this case, producing a biophotovoltaic cell with enhanced efficiency. And this was down to some innovative use of man-made nanomaterials alongside the cyanobacteria.
And so cyanobacteria, I mean, we all know that plants photosynthesize, but I mean, exactly what is a cyanobacterium? I assume it also photosynthesizes. Is that right?
Yeah, it's cyanobacterium is an evolutionarily ancient organism, and yes, it does photosynthesize and respire, and it's actually quite closely related to the plant cells that we learn about today in biology classes, because somewhere along the evolutionary chain, some other bacterium basically swallows a cyanobacterium whole. And I've learned this process is called endosymbiosis. And this larger bacterium was the ancestor of plant cells, where the cyanobacterium actually eventually became a chloroplast. And I sort of somehow remember from GCSE biology that a chloroplast is the organelle which carries out photosynthesis. So cyanobacteria have been around for a long, long time, and they are able to survive in almost every environment on Earth. And they are indeed capable of carrying out photosynthesis in their own right.
And so what is the sort of output of the cyanobacteria? Are they sort of facilitating a chemical reaction that can then be sort of harnessed to produce an electric current? Is that what happens?
So I'm not up on the biology, but I do know that a current is produced when you incorporate the cyanobacteria into the correct solar cell configuration.
And one other, there's lots of really interesting things about this particular piece of technology, but it's how various nanostructures were used, both to sort of enhance the performance of the cyanobacteria, but also to, I think light capturing mechanisms on their own, allowing it to operate over a very wide range of wavelengths. What were some of the features there of the device?
So it's a really interesting system. The researchers began by growing some zinc oxide nanorods, which are known to be photoactive in the UV region of the solar spectrum. So out of all the range of wavelengths that make up the solar spectrum, zinc oxide nanorods are active in this high energy region. And this may be high energy, but UV light is less intense than visible light in the solar spectrum. So they're useful. The usefulness of the zinc oxide nanorods could, in theory, be improved by extending their photoactive range into this visible light region. So the researchers achieved this by coating the zinc oxide nanorods with gold nanoparticles. Now, these are known to exhibit a phenomenon called localized surface plasmon resonance, or LSPR for short. And what that means is if you irradiate gold nanoparticles with light of the correct wavelength, the nanoparticles generate an enhanced local electromagnetic field. And this can induce hot electrons, which are then injected into the zinc oxide nanorods. And in this way, you can extend the photoactive range of your system. Like you said, these nanomaterials do harness light in their own right. But what the researchers then did is add the cyanobacteria to this hybrid nanostructures photoanode. And they showed with photoelectrochemical tests that the gold nanoparticles firstly did in fact improve the performance of the zinc oxide nanorods, and also that the cyanobacteria further improved the efficiency of the solar cell. But that wasn't it. They didn't stop just with that, because they carried out further work to understand exactly what was going on. And that involved electromagnetic fields, simulations and measurements. And what they found was that the hybrid nanostructure scattered light towards the cyanobacteria, which were positioned at the top of the photoanode. And this led to the conclusion that, as well as the zinc oxide nanorods, the gold nanoparticles and the cyanobacteria all harvesting light, and that's light in a very broad range of the solar spectrum, but the nanorods and nanoparticles actually also enhance the efficiency of the cyanobacteria. So they really did work together.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I suppose very clever use of a number of different technologies. But I think perhaps the most amazing thing about this device is that it actually continues to produce electricity when you switch off the lights. So when it's dark, why is that?
Yeah, and that is a capability of this solar cell that you certainly wouldn't expect from a typical solar cell. And it's possible because cyanobacteria continue to respire in the dark. So for a time, when, as you say, when you switch off the light, this solar cell continued to produce a current while the bacteria broke down stored carbon intermediates. Now, it wasn't really clear to me from the paper how long this can go on for, because in this study, the cycles of light and dark were for 5 minutes. So they had 5 minutes of light, 5 minutes of dark. But at least we know that the dark current can be produced for at least 5 minutes. I mean, I would mention that it was a reduced photocurrent compared to the solar cell functioning in the light, because in the dark, the man-made nanomaterials were not active. But nevertheless, I think this is a really fascinating demonstration of this capability that isn't shown by typical solar cells. And it does address a problem as well, because obviously the widely talked about problem with solar power is that it is intermittent. So we need adequate energy storage technology to go along with it, or we can only use solar power during the daytime or, you know, when it's not cloudy. So it doesn't address a problem, and I do wonder whether it will be developed further.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. And thanks for writing about that for us. So you mentioned that that this is this sort of work is sort of related to your research that you're doing, but not exactly the same. What exactly are you doing for your PhD?
So my project takes a surface science approach to characterizing organometal halide perovskites. And these are an emerging solar cell material, which the fundamental understanding of which still has room to be improved upon. So I guess the ultimate goal of my project is to provide information which will improve the efficiency of perovskite solar cells while minimizing their degradation while operating in real-life conditions.
And how far into the work are you at the moment?
I am midway through my second year, so I just recently had my upgrade fiver.
And how is the lockdown affecting you? I'm guessing you're not able to go into the lab, but are you sort of busy, writing up chapters or getting work done ahead of time?
Yeah, I mean, there's always more to write up or to read. As I mentioned, I just had my viva, so I'd written up most of my report, most of my recent results for my report. But there was plenty I could get on with, such as just writing some early thesis chapters way ahead of time, as well as just consolidating my background knowledge and planning ahead for the experiments that I will do when I'm back in the lab.
And of course, you've also been doing a bit of writing for us. Why did you join our student contributor network? What did you find attractive about it?
Well, I'm really interested in the whole field of science communication. I think it's very important and often goes overlooked. It seemed like a really good opportunity to work alongside some like-minded students and try and get the word out that there is really interesting research going on that sometimes seems slightly less accessible than maybe I think it really is.
And you can read Robin's article, Cyanobacteria and Nanomaterials Give Solar Cell a Boost, on the Physics World website. And if you are interested in joining our student contributor network, please do get in touch. Thanks for being on the Physics World Weekly podcast, Robin.
Thanks very much, Hamish.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Giovanna Fragnetto, Winfried Henzinger, and Robin Carr for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, You can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice. Or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.